Education, the podcast where the real world meets the digital world as we explore the intersection of spatial computing and AI. Let's welcome our host, Andrew Ballard. Over to you, AB.
Well, g'day and welcome to Spatial. This is episode 16, coming to you in early April, just after an Easter break. Some of us extended, some of us did another 1,000 Ks on motorbikes, some of us, by the sound of it, are getting ready for spring break over in the northern part of the world. Welcome anyway. This is a longer episode. This one is dedicated to just one topic. We've got most of the gang here. We've got Merrick, we've got Violet, we've got William, and there's a running chance, but not a guaranteed chance, that you might not just be able to listen to us, but actually watch us. We are experimenting with another recording medium. Audio is good, but video may also be coming. So, yes, most of us did our hair today. Merrick, wow, you are on point. Well done. And if you need to see on point, you probably need to find us on the YouTube or wherever that's being posted. For today's episode, though, we're going to be talking about generative spatial AI. How we can use spatial AI to make design proposals, basically going into the building space. So this is home turf for Violet and William. I just joked there before we started, this is your origin story. I'd like to hear not only how you got into this field, but whether this field was the thing that propelled you into, I guess, thinking about spatial and AI together. We will pass it over to both Violet and William to kick off the conversation. But look, this is a deeper dive. This is a longer topic. So let's get started. This one should be a meaty one. Violet, over to you.
All right. Well, I'm going to share my screen because I want to give a more visual taste of what we're talking about today. And I'll try and also use words in case we don't have...
For those people with ears only, we shall describe it. But those who can watch along... Right.
That's right. Alrighty. Are you seeing full screen? Ish. All right. Okay. So today we're going to talk about generative AI and specifically how it's going to change the spatial design process. So I wanted to just kind of look at the design process as it's changing now, like some of the things that I've seen. I came from architecture background for a while, as well as William. So we've seen a lot of stuff emerging there. Here in the upper left corner, you're seeing text to 3D rendering. This used to be a really painful process where you have to render buildings and it would take hours, sometimes a whole evening to render a design. You have to pick all the materials. It's like, it used to be so painful, and it's hilarious now that you can just say, I want a building to look like this, and it will take a model you already have and render it out. So that's interesting. Here in the middle, we have an AI-generated assets for video games. So another kind of text-to-something model here. You type some text, like, I want a unicorn that prances around and is this color. And it generates the 3D of those game assets. And one thing I'll show on the next slide is, like, also we're starting to see not just 3D models here. We're actually seeing animated characters based on, like, from text prompt. And then also artists have been using this for quite a while. This is, again, not generative, not some of the more current generative AI, but I think it's interesting, you know, just visually how it's changing art processes. So Roblox is a company that's starting to use generative AI so that people can actually program full games and functionality. So here you see someone typing, like, turn the lights on every time this happens, and it actually changes the functionality in the game. So it's really interesting to have, like, programming actually changing spatial design. And before all this came out, we had, before all this generative AI stuff, I actually came more from the realm of generative design and architecture. And what that all means is, like, using computers to generate lots of designs so that you can find designs. So it's like Delve, this is the product I was on the right. But in the architecture space, you'll use just a bunch of parameters for a computer model and then generate hundreds or thousands of designs. And then you evaluate them for all kinds of like goals. Oh, this one's more walkable. This one has better daylight. And it's much better to do that than designing each design one off. So I think we're going to start to see generative AI also start to impact things like generative design. Last example I'll show here, just because I think it's really interesting, is that this I came across also before the realm of generative AI is someone designing a hospital based on the schedule and sequence of appointments. So I think it's interesting to think about spatial design changing doesn't just mean like physical elements of the design. It could also mean like how you choreograph something like appointments so that things don't overlap a certain way. It's still a very spatial problem. How do you sequence those events?
This is a
super interesting.
This is a floor plan with different iterations of, you know, walking distance from A to B. And I guess if this was 2024, you'd actually have active agents in a 3D space and queuing up and, you know, like a farm simulator kind of game. But this is obviously a few years. Maybe this is an expert system. Is that perhaps what this kind of tool was? The beginnings of logic, but not necessarily machine learning?
Yeah, I don't even know if this was just... This is probably just like some brute force thing.
Gotcha.
Where
someone's three, 4 days of tinkering, thinking, and coming up with the classic way of human task goal.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but super...
Perfect example of if you could try every permutation, which one or ones
I can totally imagine this now with like NVIDIA's Omniverse, like you're saying, these like 3D simulations of sequence. And I'm sure it's going to impact things like, fabrication and factories. Okay, so I'll stop there. But I basically wanted to kick us off with this premise, kind of big. How will generative AI change the design process? And maybe I'd be curious just to hear from you all. Let me stop sharing.
I love the concept of it's just a grid or it's a plethora of ideas. A lot of people think that AI is the holy grail. You do it once and it does the perfect job. That is a distant future. It is really more of that generative assistant that can guide a few options. I've seen a lot of tools in recent days, actually, of 3D object makers by generative AI that give you a grid of, if you're after a treasure box for a game, it'll do a 3D model and it can do 50 by 50, so, you know, 2,500 on a page. And the human then comes along and says, oh, I like that one, and that one. Iterate again based on those design specs. And that speed of ideas is, what you could have done if you were doing designs in 10 minutes each. But yeah, it just gives you, to badly quote, three amigos, many plethora of ideas. And that smorgasbord is just enough to, you know, say swipe left to some of them and swipe right to the precious few.
Yeah, I'm curious. So we've seen, one thing that's interesting to me is that we've seen a lot of examples of generative AI in a kind of like creative brainstorming capacity, and it tends to be like this very aesthetic thing. But I think we can also see examples of it being really beyond just aesthetic. It can be functional, and also beyond the brainstorming phase. Like, can it help in the kind of later stages and execution phase? So I'm curious, from your all's background, do you think that this is something that's going to have a more impact on the earlier, later stages? Do you think it's going to have more impact on the loosey-goosey creative process, or is it going to have more process, more impact on those kind of more fundamental things?
Yeah, is it more of the low-value smorgasbord, or is it up in the medium value, help me refine one or two designs? Or is it, we've settled on this one last design, can we iterate that and finalize it and sign off? I definitely would think it's in the lower third, moving upwards slowly. I dare say the human in the loop is the top of that pyramid who does the final sign off. But yeah, by all means, it's definitely able to assist in the multiple options on small things. And if you can give it the right goals of minimize foot traffic, maximize something, if you can find a goal to aim it towards, you can do the classic AI training with a reward and give it a few hours or days of cycles and tell it to come back when it's found the best answer, top answers. Yeah.
Probably depends on what you're looking for, right? Because these, I mean, I keep following, I can show you parametric architecture, which is where I wanted to, I'm going to get there. But it seems like the idea state of a project like that might be quite different than the actual execution, because what you like and what you feel like might be what you're looking for could be simply impossible to build or too expensive or just very impractical, right? Like then there's this like maybe big step or gap between this sort of like application of AI that helps you dream up an idea and then the actual execution, which is very technical and needs to somehow translate to the construction techniques we have or we can do and into the economy of what you're building, probably, right?
I'm also almost kind of curious to hear from William, because William was head of product at this company called Floor that very much like had to bake in all these really rigorous rules. It wasn't like, it was almost the opposite of loosey-goosey in some ways. So kind of curious what you think, William.
Yeah, we had a kind of interesting niche in some ways. We were actually more like a 3D visualization company. We had an engineering team who were really, really good at 3D graphics at the time, and who are still really great at it. But this was 10 years ago, and so having like WebGL in your browser was a new thing. And we had a suite of products from an Oculus Rift installation for the retail space at the Hudson Yards development in New York City, to a very kind of rich editing environment for 3D experiences that were intended for a broker to send to their clients so that they could see a space outfitted with furniture and their brand colors and whatnot in a video game-like experience. So you could, in your browser, just kind of walk around like Doom, but it was like Doom or some other first-person game. But it would be very high-quality rendering. It would have actual Herman Miller chairs, like things like that. And we had 3D modeling artists who were tuning the models of those furniture for that particular rendering engine. And so the generative aspect is when we shipped a product for the same audience, for office brokers in particular, where they could take an iPad or a laptop and modify a floor plan. And so if you wanted to change conference rooms to desk benching, you could just swipe your finger and tap benching, and it would calculate the optimal layout given a certain set of preferences for those benching desks. And the innovation there, I think, was the fact that we could take that sort of out of the hands of the designers and put it into the hands of the brokers, but the designer's logic was part of the kind of the parametric constraints that Mirek is referring to. And we could ship that product relatively quickly because the constraints around offices and the ideal design layouts were pretty straightforward. We had a very skilled interior designer, interior architect, Lauren Popish, who wrote all of the rules for those particular spaces. She had tons of experience working at Gensler, which is one of the largest architecture firms in the world and one that you would go to for like very, very large office deployments. And so it was a really curious thing to say, hey, like instead of calling up your architect, you just have it as an app. So it's kind of an example of how we were displacing some of that architectural labor. But in some ways, there's a lot that goes on in architecture as a kind of spatial design field that is similar in some ways to the, like in paradigmatically similar, I would argue, to the more mundane physical tasks that we see being replaced by, like through the Industrial Revolution and now in the sort of robotics revolution. So there's a lot more than renderings that goes on in building design. It's often behind the scenes, particularly on large projects that folks really don't really know unless they've really interacted with an architect. And so things like writing the architectural program for a large building, that could be hundreds or thousands of pages of written text on the requirements of the building, interpreting building codes, particularly overlaid building codes, because at the national and local levels, there are different requirements. And then writing the specifications, like the drawings sort of get all the glory in the architectural design process, but there are thousands and thousands of pages written about that specify materials, that specify finishes, the way that things are supposed to be installed and so forth. And that hasn't even gotten really to the contractor yet, who often have to replicate those same instructions in more detail. In my mind, those are some tasks that are right up for grabs for generative AI as we know it, particularly textual large language models. And so it's curious. It's really fascinating for me from that perspective to think about, can sort of lower level projects where maybe an owner of a smaller building is tempted to hire an architect, but we might have displaced a bit of that with some generative AI tools who can interpret the building code for them and generate some renderings and then go from sort of rendering to 2D drawings that are required for filing in the buildings department. Like I think that there's some projects there that definitely could be some prototypes for something like that.
So it's starting with low level, but then by the sound of it, you were getting to quite a mature level of sophistication for final output of that choose your own layout tool. What sort of level of final human touch was required to massage it from output from the system to final document form, final drawing form? Was it a halfway house? Was it 80%? I mean, the numbers are arbitrary, but was it most of the way, or was it just a good slab of the way? Then the humans got involved, and I dare say the billing got involved to actually do the final bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, at Floored, that product that we called ProtoFit at the time was just for test fits and just for offices. And the way that it was built, or the way that the process worked, was we would consume drawings from the owner of the building or from the broker, whoever had them, and then we would have to convert them manually into the format that worked for that particular product for ProtoFit behind the scenes. And once it was built into that kind of specialized semantic form, then we could render it as a floor plan and make it interactive, and we could also render it in 3D so that you could see the 3D changes. And so not only did we have to copy the floor plan and into this sort of very specialized semantic model, we also designed four layouts for them. And so there was a lot of human work paired with all of the engineering work and the product work. There was an internal platform and then a customer-facing product. So by the time it got to the broker, it was already laid out for them, and they could make changes. And the reason was we discovered for the user experience, the reason for that was we discovered that brokers didn't have time to design. Like they weren't really designers per se. That sort of generative aspect of creating and observing a hypothetical world that designers are very, very good at. That wasn't their business. Like, that's why they hired architects to do that for them. But they were exceptionally good at identifying what didn't work in an existing floor plan. They would say, this conference room is in the wrong place. This one's too small. You want to put it next to the entrance so that you can take your high-value customers and go directly from the reception desk into the main conference room. Like, they were really, really sharp at that.
They didn't know what they wanted.
To give them that experience.
But they knew what they didn't want. Yeah, that used to be called a client type
exactly.
A in my world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it was really great. It was really great to watch that happen once we got the product in their hands.
Is flawed.
I think that
figure.
What's interesting about this is what William is bringing up, and what you're bringing up, Andrew, is where the human comes in to smooth everything out. And so if humans are going to be part of like smoothing out what the AI can't do yet, what are the first things that AI should pick up in the design process? Is it going to be things like, maybe it's helpful to be more specific here in terms of what type of design process. So, you know, for William and I, we're probably thinking a lot more about the design of buildings, but maybe you can all kind of illustrate for us, Mirek and Andrew. I'd love to hear you illustrate the design problems you're working on in what domain. And maybe I'll just start by saying, walk us through the current design process you have and where you see generative AI coming in first. Like, what is it going to do before humans are able to do that? And if you don't mind, Mirek, can I ask you?
Can I show you what I've been working on first? It's quite different than all this. It's all very rough on the surface, and I'd never published it, but I think it's quite entertaining.
Excellent.
Let me turn on.
We like entertaining.
Again, we'll talk to it, but if we are in a more visual medium, we will just point to it.
So this is parametric architecture on Instagram. I just wanted to set the stage with what we consider innovative and beautiful these days. So it's these like organic shapes, crazy geometries. This might be generated by AI easily, right? Either as a 2D image or a 3D model. But the other thing is how do you actually make a shape like that? So I was thinking that you might actually, work with geometry and come up with a construction technique that is fully under your control. And then I spent some time doing that, and I ended up with something that is actually a piece of software that runs in the cloud. And you feed it geometry, you can modify the geometry, and produces these sort of 3D printable shapes. This is the interface that I came up with. So you feed it some data, you can modify the geometry as you go, and it calculates what sort of material you need, and it generates the unique pieces on the fly. So all those joints that you saw there are unique, are labeled, and come out of your printer with like little label on it, so you know where it goes. And there's AR element to it, so you can actually, see the thing in the one-to-one scale,
so
walk through it,
and
you can actually modify everything. Yeah. Live. So I'm doing this, and on the background in the cloud there's something doing the calculation, and then I get all sorts of pieces, and I built this little mock-up. It's actually a lot of work. It took surprisingly a lot of effort, and I was wondering if it scales up, if you can use this kind of thing to build something bigger. And I spent quite a lot. I'm just going to fast forward in this video.
Let me describe this for 10 seconds for our people listening along. This is like those climbing gyms you'd play on as a kid, the half domes. But what you've got here are, you've got 3D printed spokes, which you then output from this, and then using dowels or broomsticks as the medium of rods to join things together. You can set your own metric imperial measurement tool, I take it. So this is what you are then able to do in augmented reality design, pull up nodes, join it how you need to. Is it also calculating things like stresses, strains, and required number of supports to make it happen?
It's not doing that. It's optimizing the 3D printed parts for strength, and it makes sure that they're oriented in the most efficient way. It's labeling them, and then it gives you a list of materials. So initially, you set it up by saying, I'm working with, you know, wooden dowels. They are this thick, this long. And it will tell you that, oh, here, as you're modifying the geometry, you've actually hit a place where you don't have as much stock material and you would run into trouble. And gotcha. This happens both in the web browser, right? This is a web interface for that. And it happens in the AR interface. I just finished building this little bit. You see that it's also kind of taking on the role of the guide, and it's telling you, okay, I've got this part, where do I put it? So there's this model of what you're building, and you can mark there your progress, so you know that this is built, I'm not gonna have to worry about that, and you can just pick the next piece, look it up, and it will tell you where it goes. So it's like it's over-engineered for what it is, and you know, given how much time I spend on it, I would like to find out some use case for it. But the other thing I built besides this is this little Tensegrid. This thing was in the initial renders also. So this is this like floating structure. It's a plant stand. It can only hold plants, but it's something that actually came from the very same process. I don't know if this is any useful. I think it's perfectly possible to build something this way. And maybe if you're going for structure, you don't want to deal with, you know, wooden fragile plastic. But the same principle could be applied to other things. I just don't know if this is for sculptures or if this is for buildings. This is just a mock-up. I was trying to show that maybe there could be Stanford bunnies at Stanford, life size or more than life size, or there could be a moai overseeing the San Francisco Bay. But who needs this, right? This is art, and if you're an artist, maybe you want to get your hands dirty and do it other way. This is pretty much like. Like what I've built in this case is this, it's not AI, it's algorithmic, but it does all the number crunching. Yeah. But it pretty much started with this construction technique that, you know, I can perfectly describe in a computer. And then as I would get further, I would definitely do some structural analysis on it, and, you know, some load spreading voodoo to make sure that actually, you know, yeah, it's gonna do what you want. But
Mirror, I'm going to die if I don't jump in here because...
please do.
Because this is such a great topic for us to go through, because William was a structures professor and has a project that's specifically using a model like this to change the structure. I don't know if he's going to be able to bring it up. But... when I was in school, I did this project that was much more manual and painful, putting together a structure kind of like this. But instead of 3D printing the joints, we used silicone so that they could stretch to the... I just have to share this now. It's going to kill me.
Can I show you one more thing? Because
please.
So it's related to this. I'm going to jump back to my screen. So this is a company, startup from, I know the founder, and he's taking a slightly different approach. So you see that, you know, they you're in Oculus, you put on the headset, and then you can design structures from these aluminum extrusions that are pretty, you know, standardized. You get parts that click on these, and it's pretty much well understood what you can do with this kind of material. So this project takes a very different approach, but it's in principle is the same. But the constraint is the building technique, which in this case is, you know, right angles,
XYZ.
Everything clicks in 90 degree. It's much more simpler. Your material is defined by what you can get. And then as you model something this way, they can sell you the parts as a kit, and that's the business model.
Gotcha.
Right? So you've got that a makes list. Sense. In my case, I wanted to start with whatever I want, and then just have something tell me how to work the material to actually make something practical. I think this approach is much smarter. I don't know how it works as a business, because I have some concerns about that. If you work with this kind of material, you probably have it at hand, and it's not as hard for you to prototype this or just wing it, you know, as you go. So it's on the other side, of the spectrum. It's too easy maybe to add more value with some sort of smart tech. I don't know. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, William and I have talked a lot about, is there ways for us to take something like McMaster Car, if you're not familiar with this, it's like this website that just has, it's a website and a bunch of products for hardware, from like springs to screws to bolts to actuators. It just has like everything under the sun in terms of hardware. And it's so painful, if you've ever prototyped something, to figure out what bolt goes with what screw and connects into this thing. And I wonder, you know, to what degree that example you just shared, Merrick.
So that whole,
are we going to see more sophisticated?
That whole McMaster catalog is integrated into Autodesk's Fusion 360. And you can just pull parts from there. And of course it makes sense, you know, as a business, because that's where you get the parts afterwards, right? But it doesn't tell you how to put them together, what the logic is there, and it doesn't help you design. I mean, things maybe click together, you know, as you would expect, but that's about it. Or work as joints, and, you know, there's some basic mechanic to it.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to put on hold the structure-like project for a second, and I want to come back to it because I'm really interested in this McMaster Car premise. And I wonder, you know, William, in your class, you've been talking a lot about like getting your students to design with higher levels of intention. So maybe you can, would you be willing to just describe that process? Maybe even show an example of, and if you can't bring it up, no worries. About this exact thing, like how do you get students to, rather than talk about a design in terms of this McMaster Car bolt, talk about the higher intention of the design, and can you have a system go fetch you parts that would do said thing?
Sure. The premise of the course is, starts from defining space, and then continues to interrogate what is AI. And so I think it's interesting for us all to think about, and this partly why this podcast exists, is when you combine those two things, what do you get? And so the course itself is starting with some of the latest technology and latest developments in AI that are popular and that are new, but that are also accessible to spatial designers. And so the variety of students I have go from classical architecture students who are intending to become architectural designers in firms, or maybe even professional architects themselves, all the way to urban planners and policymakers and so forth. So finding a place where I have 26 students in the course. There are three who are professional software engineers, or were in the past, and three who have never seen a line of code in their lives. And then how do I make artificial intelligence accessible to them? And so the large language models are really great at that. And so the way that I frame the course, to at least in this first instance, is saying, well, let's talk about forms of spatial reasoning that we can engage through text. And so if I can describe a design with at a very high level, so I'm interested in, say, the social aspects of a particular public space, or I'm interested in certain types of experience, can I find a way to go from those ideas and break down my own semantic model all the way down to the individual operations I need to perform geometrically to propose a design. And so that's what we've been doing. We've been simulating 3D environments with just a simple game engine, really, and then saying, and then poking at the large language models to say, this was the first exercise was kind of fun. At least it was fun for me. Like, there's a ton of balls being dropped from the top of this virtual space, and the challenge is to contain as many of them as possible. And so you can ask it to position boxes and spheres in this virtual space, but can you get the model to not only respond to individual instructions, like put a box here, but instead put a wall here? Oh, and walls are modeled as boxes that are long and thin and tall. Well, then can you say, wrap this or contain this space and have it understand that in order to contain a space, it needs to put up walls, and walls are then boxes, and then it has the ability to add boxes to this virtual environment. And they do surprisingly well, actually. The GPT models are really good at this when you put enough effort into the prompts and to the system context. So it's that's the premise. And the hope and the dream is that we'll be able to describe whole design propositions. So could you take mid-century modernism and the sort of white box international style and those notion of like ribbon and punched windows and the different types of experience that Le Corbusier and Mies van der Rohe were investigating at that time? Can you actually create a functional design language in natural language? And the pioneer William Mitchell, involved at the MIT Media Lab, his work, The Logic of Architecture, is very much in line with this. But it took a formal language approach where his work looked at Palladian villas and made an argument for how you could break sort of spatial propositions down into this formal language that looks almost like symbolic logic to a certain degree. And has this treatise around how programming languages work, and it's inspired a lot of my work throughout the past few years. And now with these language models, particularly with the function calling capabilities of LLMs, it's just I think we're only just starting to see the capabilities here. So that's the primary parts of the course, and then finally we're starting to integrate some of the more traditional AI, like spatial AI technologies that we've been talking about as well. So things like the either the vision models or facial recognition, or trying to understand depth estimation and how do you interrogate the metrics of a particular space. And so now the final project is to set up a set of kind of imaginary sensors or real sensors like webcams, and then scrub them through multiple layers of models and then reason about those inputs with an LLM. So it's I think this is the way to make these highly, highly technical AI methods accessible to these particular spatial designers.
Yeah, I love the fact there's
No, no, go ahead.
I'm just seeing a thread across all of us here with our examples of igloo making, spatial tool generation. That the general trend I'm sort of seeing is that we're not trying to get to 100% and perfect, but I think almost every level of someone's prowess in a field, hand wave and a big statement here, but can be elevated slightly by these kinds of tools. There are ways to bring you from being a novice to a junior, from a junior to a midweight, from a creator to a hobbyist, those sort of things. I dare say the top of that pyramid, to come all the way back to the first sort of topics, was that probably you can't elevate yourself from I'm looking at two here, adjunct professor to full-blown professor. There's probably some gaps there that last gap is, the nine nines and may not be hit today, I hope. But in the midweight levels, there are tools and ways to speed up some thought processes, take advantage of the previous learnings from previous expert systems who have got more experience, and, you know, hasten your arrival at some more elevated levels. This probably means there's fraught with danger. I'm probably got a project manager in my head right now saying risk, risk, oh my God, you know, to Merrick's igloo structures, they are phenomenal. And same with the aluminium orthogonal structures. In my engineering realms, I, for the record, I did do engineering back in my undergrad because it was the closest thing I could find to robotics. I was ahead of my time. Hello, welcome to the world. They got me trying to do robots for car manufacturing plants, which in Australia now don't exist. So I chose the wrong, I chose the right path to start and then diverge. But one of the biggest life lessons from my engineering working experience was I was given a small task at a summer job and told to design a platform for something to hold a certain weight. And of course, I went back to math and did the structure analysis and the shear force and the thing and the thing. And I decided it needed a M14 bolt. And I reported that back to my supervisors, who said, sounds good. If you're not sure, just make it a bigger bolt. And that was the engineering heuristics, the rule of thumb for everything. All that condensed logic would be, yep, I reckon that needs a 20 mil bolt rather than a 15 mil bolt, you know. So math was good, but those rules of thumb were fantastic. I'm just going to ask around yourselves now, do you think that level of expert system logic that has been baked into these large language models by trawling the world's internet for text, we're now seeing that emerge slowly as general world models, what we're starting to talk about, spatially aware models with vision, depth, 3D. Do you think that those logics of, William, your flawed expertise of floor plan layout, are those going to trickle down fast enough and be good enough to avert risk? Or is this simply a guide with an asterisk and a caveat saying, use at own risk, consult a professional, don't use for, you know, don't take it onto the road. At what level do you think we're going to be seeing that transition from guide hobbyist creator tools to, no, you can take these to the bank. You can use this forever for real life. Love to get your point of view of how much knowledge trickling down till it becomes rock solid.
I really think that what we're going to see is we're going to have very rigorously tested rules. So take, for example, the igloo that we just saw, or like those, the, I love the premise that we can create like all these bizarre shapes now. Well, we can have a structural model that is not Gen AI that tests whatever layout you're creating, but the layout itself can be from higher level intent. You can say like, oh, could I make a bookcase of this? Oh, could I turn this into a pergola? You know, like, I think that's where Gen AI can shine. And I think that there's, I don't know when the trust is going to come from like a generative model, especially for something that's structural.
But I think the trust and even like real world utility value will come from expert systems. So you can imagine a language model or something like that that's expert in your local building code. And then depending on what you're building with, you can consult your design with an expert mason AI or expert woodworker AI and throw design at it and ask it, is this something we can build? And you get an answer from this field of expertise and you can run it through the building code AI to give you approval if, you know, whatever we came up here, or you might have a structural assistant who understands the physics of what you're building and will, you know, take a peek and give you really quick but educated guess whether this would work. And as you're moving on with this design, with this process, maybe you can spend more time, you know, compute time on each task and come up with the whole thing bit by bit. So I think these expert systems will start popping up in every field. And so it's a question of making them talk together, I think, efficiently, exchange data in a meaningful way, and then have them do their bits, because I think like our human knowledge is structured around, you know, topics and jobs. So maybe that's how we're going to come up with artificial experts for that. And maybe, you know, bringing them together like this would work much better than my approach, which is like, okay, I need to design everything because otherwise I don't know how to control the design, right? So if you have this crazy designer, architect AI that's just hallucinating whatever might be fancy and whatever pleases the consumer, the human, then you can run it through some more rational AIs. To critique it and try to figure out like how do we actually build this thing.
I'm just going to go register that domain now before everyone else does, sensible.ai. No, you're quite right. If we've gone from language model AI, image cat dog detectors, and now we're moving into general world models, spatial reasoning, it makes perfect sense. We're going to go deeper into niches of domain expertise. But I think you're even more correct, Mary, totally, that the interaction and the interfacing between those bespoke sensible AIs is going to be a world of pain for someone to solve. That someone will probably be very popular if they can solve that problem. William, your sort of point of view of that expert system floating down, users using it in your class and others, you know, getting more advanced by using that knowledge, where do you think that might meet in the middle? Where's that sort of transition point from I've used all the tools I can today, now I do need to consult? Is that rising or is that still going to stay in the middle stable ground of the humans have to live here?
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think there's the tolerances for whether an architect will be allowed to use these tools from a kind of professional perspective. That's going to take some time. It's still like, even with as much computation as we use in the building industry, at least in the West today, it's still, in the US, it still comes down to an architect putting their stamp on those drawings. So that is accepting a certain level of liability for 10 years, at least after the project is done. And I should make a caveat as well, though, that a lot of the comments that I'm making, at least, are from the perspective of Western architecture, from the Western architecture market, from the U.S. and most of Europe, and probably Australia as well, but East Asia is far ahead of where we are in terms of adopting automated and AI systems for the building industry. It's sort of known that as Shanghai was being rapidly built up. You know, 10, 20 years ago, that the AI systems being used, the architectural tools there were quite a bit far beyond what we were using in the US. There were code checking systems, generative systems, that were expert systems, precisely, that to your point, that were all being used for those massive skyscrapers that that are so beautiful now in the sort of nighttime photos of Shanghai. And even just recently, August last year, there was an article published in The Guardian about a company in China called XCool that is using generative AI for the building industry. And it is things like master planning that they're using it for, all sorts of capabilities that are beyond just the kind of visuals that we see being experimented with in schools and with Midjourney. So daylighting requirements, space standards, local planning regulations, generating interiors and construction details. So they're very ambitious. I don't think their tool has been released yet in the US, at least it wasn't at the time. But we can put this link to this article in the show notes. But this is really, so this notion of generative AI tools combined with these advanced expert systems where like it's far more reliable to just say the logic, since the logic is there and in literally in code, maybe it's written in natural language, but it is a building code. I definitely see where that's going to, where the rubber hits the road. Like it's that risk management profile that really governs the building industry to a large degree. And so making sure that the contractor, the architect, all the subcontractors, all of the, and even the sort of squishier requirements of public relations around major projects in particular are all handled. Like that's, like the expert systems, I think, are going to be really valuable there.
Nice one. No, brilliant. No, trust is definitely the bar. I think that it's not the glass ceiling. It just definitely is the point where, you know, we can say let's actually go ahead, or it's a tool. It's not a toy, but it's a guide. But that bar is raising almost certainly. I can't say every year. It's raising faster than that. I think every couple of months we get sort of advances that push it forward. Violet, can pass back to you to give us a final summary and conclusion. Did we answer the question of the premise of the thesis today?
Please.
Before you wrap up, I'm actually thinking about one thing that's related to this, and I'm wondering where you guys are on it. What do you think about 3D printing in architecture, large scale, concrete or not? Is that the answer? Because I have opinions, but I think I'd rather let you speak.
I think it's going to depend on labor costs. Like that's 2x4 construction is so inexpensive. Maybe it also depends on things like unions. I think the most difficult thing is probably things like changing building codes to abide by a completely new construction process. And like William was saying around like all these regulations, we're so set in a world that it's like, I almost feel like 2x4 stick construction is like what the QWERTY keyboard is to the computer. We're like stuck with it because it was baked in early on. So I kind of feel like we're going to be stuck with 2x4 construction because all the codes and processes.
IKEA hasn't got a section for curved furniture, sadly. But
like the keyboard, it actually works and it's really efficient, right?
Yeah, it's like it's got its problems. Like we could probably do better, but like, you know, no one wants to like overhaul the whole system, or it's really expensive to change all these processes that have already been set up for it. So I'm hopeful that there's some niche where it can exist, but I don't know where that niche is. I think it's like a salmon trying to swim. Well, that's a bad analogy because salmons do swim upstream. It's like something trying to swim upstream that cannot.
Merrick, you think it's a price problem or a concept problem?
Actually, I have something I would like to touch on, because I actually spent considerable time looking into stick framing and how, you know, houses are built in North America, just looking for something you can optimize with a robot or, you know, calculate better. But the thing is that over the centuries, this process is so well optimized that there's very little you can make better. And if you just throw two guys on something, you'll have, you know, structure of a house in 2 weeks or a month. And, you know, as opposed to needing really specialized gear and a bunch of engineers coming on site and setting up a gigantic printer to print something that's kind of limiting in what it can be. Maybe even like we can argue if it's practical, if it's aesthetically pleasing, that's one element to it. The other is practicality and how remodeling a 3D printed house, or just like deciding that you want power socket somewhere, you know, 2 months after it's been printed, whether it's feasible to modify a structure like that and where it actually leaves you. So there's all sorts of approaches and like views of this. I don't think some years ago, these companies like Icon and others started by claiming that this is super sustainable, super green, and then they turn out printing with concrete. So how green is that? And I don't know. I just don't feel like it justifies itself on this planet. But on this planet is kind of important, because as we want to build, you know, on the moon and Mars, that works like a charm. And you just use local materials and crush them into whatever, make little Mars concrete, and here you go. And it's the opposite. It's the simplest possible approach there. But here, I don't see the cost of it. I don't see how it's going to combat homelessness or do anything, you know, like you often hear these companies claim. It's not very ecological. And in terms of cost of labor, it actually requires a lot of specialized personnel to build something that, you know, maybe you don't even need in the first place, and it's not going to be cheaper, and it's not going to be, maybe it's not going to even feel like a house. It's going to feel like a spaceship, and people want to live in houses.
So in summary, so. Good idea, wrong planet.
Yes. That's my main, that's my bottom line.
Yeah.
I also think that there's potentially something to optimizing the instruction. So, you know, Williams talked a lot with this company, Mosaic, and that's really thinking around how do we automatically create the instructions for assembling the building. And I know, you know, this is an area that you're working on a lot, Murex, thinking a little bit about, you know, how do you actually give instructions to a robot or a person to put something together? So I think that maybe is the area where a lot of optimization can happen, like coordinating different subcontractors that come in. And if you have a model that comes from something that's like NVIDIA Omniverse, and you can have something on the site that checks, like, has that been built yet? Should this happen next? And then can generate sets of instructions for like what goes in next. And, you know, use something like Murex developed, where you actually can, you know, AR or whatever, see where this 2x4 should go. Perhaps that helps.
I think you don't need to like go maybe as slow as your 2x4. What I actually learned is that there is a lot of improvement of efficiency, but it usually comes down to pre-building parts of your house in the warehouse somewhere with big robots. With robotic arms, with tools that can reach wherever you need them. They don't need to move, you know, it's not as dynamic environment as the job site would be. And then you take these parts, put it on a truck, move it to where you need them, and that seems to be the most efficient way. And you definitely have some, there's expert systems that these companies use, exactly like William mentioned that. And you have some creative freedom. You can modify the house if you're kind of, you know, we're talking right angles here, but you can have the door a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left. There's some kind of customizability baked into these products, and I think it's the most innovative that I've seen. And, you know, besides that, it's just a bunch of guys doing the woodwork, and they know what they're doing, so it's going to be fast. It's not going to cost fortune. You're building with wood, so you're storing carbon. It's good for the planet if you source your wood from well-managed forest, and all these things kind of come together. Layman's perspective.
Yeah. Well, I think with that, maybe the most important thing that we took away today is that generative AI is going to change design, perhaps most on Mars, but it's definitely going to change the processes here, but there's a lot to overhaul in the way that our existing world is already set up for a lot of things that maybe aren't ready to change or like partially set in stone.
No, I hear you. There's just the same with the building story. If you can hire two more people at X dollars per hour, that solves so many problems. A consultant mind trick is to set the future at the right level of future so that it's obviously just can't be solved by adding one more person today. So oftentimes in my field, I don't want to say, let's think about 20 years in the future when we've all got matrix style neural jacks. That's silly. You don't get any traction. But you also don't get traction if you paint a picture of the future tomorrow with 5% better or 10% better, because you can just solve that by adding one more thing. But I think we're all here because we can see that the future in a middle future in 1 or 2 years, although one or two years will almost always never come in this field. It's coming at a great rate of knots, but these tools are here without fail. We'll put all the links in the show notes. The question is whether the tools can give you 5% boost in efficiency, creativity, or 95% boost. The answer is somewhere in the middle, and you know your mileage will vary. But there's ways to get a to get a lift, to get ahead, to be inspired, to, if need be, have the, was it sensible.ai check you one day, and the things that we do whimsically can be fact-checked and reference-checked and building code checked and everything checked. I think we're definitely painting a picture of humans can have a bit more fun in the future, and then we'll let the AI do the boring stuff. That's plan A anyway. I do note John Stewart just did his lovely Daily Show monologue on AI taking jobs. All good. That's a topic for a different day. But right now, it's about creativity, playing, and, yeah, jumping up a half a level in your maturity of what can I grab from the expert systems and learnings from the tools higher up, and how can I use that to advance my own, you know, fast-track my own pace of playing around for 2D, for space optimization, for 3D, for building. Oh, phenomenal. Mirik, when's the Igloo, the Phantom Cybernetics Igloo creation software going to be released? Because that's something that I know
I put it on ice about a year ago, because I really don't know what to do with it. It's too much work. I was almost about to announce a product that you can do to do exactly what I did. But there's just too much to do to make it like any more useful. So if anybody has any crazy ideas for what this could be used, I'm all ears.
All good. Right in. Pester us, hit us up on LinkedIn and say, Mirik, we want more igloos, or we want more tensegrity plant holders, or I want the Stanford Bunny in Stanford tomorrow.
I can make many of those.
Excellent. The vision's correct. The tool, sure, is phenomenal. But no, I hear you that is it a product or not? That's all right. We'll look forward to the release of that. Well, thanks, team. We might leave it there. That's a long episode. We'll cut it up for audio straight away for you, for your listening pleasure. And then, if you're watching this, yeah, good to see our faces. Good to see us. And yes, our robot backgrounds need to be more on point. We need to get more robots in. You've got living animals. I've got living animals. William's got the many plethora of everything, and then Mirik is winning on the robot front. So, yeah, we will lift our robot game shortly.
Cold metal.
Cold hard metal. Nice one. Well, thanks, everyone. That's it for this episode of Spatial, and we'll catch you on the next one. For now, bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you'd like more news and insights about Spatial AI, or have a story or interesting topic you'd like us to cover, reach out to us. Better yet, come and join the community at Spatial. All the links are in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.